Ben is in Genesis 22 today, Genesis 22. And we're going to read beginning in verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abram. And he said to Abraham, and he said, "Here I am." And then he says, "Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I should tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, and he saddled his donkey, and he took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering, and he rose and went to the place of which God had told him. And then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes, and he saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and he laid it on Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And then he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." So the two of them went together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there and placed wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son, and he laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." So he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not lay a hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And then Abraham lifted his eyes, and he looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Abraham went, and he took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of the heaven, and he said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessings I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars are of the heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to the young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt in Beersheba.
All right, good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning. Welcome to Believers Church. That's an awesome scene there, isn't it? Anybody ever seen that before? It's actually pulled out of the Bible Epic miniseries. How many people just want to keep watching, see what happens? Just cut the sermon out. Okay, we'll make some popcorn. Nobody said yes, so I guess we'll proceed with the sermon this morning. This is a really famous, well-known story from the Bible that we're covering today. And that clip did a great job capturing the raw emotion of it. I mean, imagine the scene. I mean, imagine what it was like to go through this as a father, being asked to sacrifice his son. They did a really amazing job of capturing that. Some of the details are a little bit, I mean, it took some liberties with that. Isaac is probably older than a teenager. He's probably 20 or 30. Abraham's probably older than, you know, a 50 or 60-year-old man. He's probably 130. But man, they nailed it as far as the heart behind that clip. Now, for those who don't know the Bible, aren't familiar with the overall story of it, this story can be very confusing. It can be a stumbling block. The plot line doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, it seems horrible that God would ask a father to sacrifice his son. So for some people, this seems like an angry and mean and evil God asking Abraham to do something terrible. And even besides that, isn't God against child sacrifice? it can be difficult to relate to what was happening here. If you're parents, it's hard to imagine being asked to do this. Everybody that I listened to who gave other sermons or gave commentary on this passage, the only thing they could really relate it to, and these are men that have children and families, they could only relate it to putting a pet to sleep after a number of years of having a dog or a cat or so on. Incidentally, Sasha and I were just over at my mom's house and she put a cat down yesterday, and so I'm not saying it's anywhere near the same thing, but the thought of scheduling the death of a dearly loved member of the family, so to speak. But this can seem like kind of a strange story unless you know the bigger picture. Now, for those that do, for those that are familiar with the Bible's message and the Bible's story, this is actually the exact opposite. This is actually a beautiful story. It's beautiful because it predicts, it precludes the story of Jesus dying on a cross for all of mankind. The Father gives up his only Son to be the sacrificial lamb to take on the punishment for our sin. That's what this story sort of prophesies, and we'll talk about that as we go today. This story communicates God's love for us, actually. God is willing to give up his very best, his only begotten Son. Okay, and so we'll talk about that as we go. It is important to realize this was a real event. This really, really happened. Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, they all lived through this. Okay, the agony, the torment, the confusion about what God was asking of them, the tension between wanting to obey God and wanting their son Isaac to live. It's not really a nice story, is it? Not pleasant. It's kind of hard to see, you know, what the shining light is through the end of it. If you know the bigger story of the Bible, you can know that. But the events were bigger than Abraham and Isaac. Okay, this becomes a prophecy that later gets fulfilled in Jesus Christ. God does the same thing to Jesus, but it's the thing that he won't let Abraham go through with in the end, allowing his son to be killed on a mountain. Now, this event also becomes sort of a lasting example. This is actually the example of faith in the Bible, of obedience to God, of what it means to live out your beliefs and your faith. And so Abraham becomes the father of faith through this series of events. So let's get into the passage here. We're going to go through it and just talk through the details this morning. Verse 1, after these things, God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham, and he said, Abraham, here I am. Now, before we launch into the details, we're going to talk about what it means that God tested Abraham. Okay, some time had passed. Abraham had had a son, Isaac. This is the promised son. And God tests Abraham here. It's important to note, this is after 40 to 50 years of Abraham walking with God. This isn't an initial test. This isn't a get over the starting line test. This is 40 or 50 years later. And he'd already been tested many times. We know this. We've been covering it every chapter in the last 10 chapters. Okay, God had tested Abraham many times. Abraham had proven himself many times. Okay, but God wasn't done with Abraham. He wasn't going to ride out the rest of his life on the basis of what he had done previously. God had more growth. God had more things to do in Abraham. Around here, Pastor Tim's given to say, we're not done, or you're not done ever until you're in a box in the ground and your soul is with God in heaven. You're not done until you reach the end of your life. Abraham was not done. Okay, this is 40 or 50 years after he started walking with God, and God just keeps ramping up the test, doesn't he? This is about as high as he could go. So even after decades of faithfully following God, there's more work to be done. And that's true for all of us, too. We'll continue to be tested. I've been a Christian for 14 years. The tests get more difficult on the basis that I pass and move on to the next one. This isn't linear by any means, but yet it is a measure of you're growing. You're getting to know God more and more. You're walking in his will more and more. We'd all hope that things would get better and easier as we do that, right? Things would be simpler, easier, and yet that's not really how it works. If there's more that God's expecting of us, honestly, the tests get harder and harder. The challenges become greater. The seriousness of them grows along with our maturity. Now, this idea of being tested, this means to be proven. It's like you're in court, you're tried over a court case, and you're proven innocent or guilty. Either you did it or you didn't do it. You're tested in that you can either pass or you can fail. You can know the answer or you can not know the answer. The same word actually means tempted as well in the Bible. It's the same root word, and depending upon the context, it can mean being tempted to do something wrong, sin. But testing isn't the same thing as tempting. There's a distinction between the two. Testing has to do with God giving us the opportunity to verify the reality of our faith. Okay, testing is a way for us to present it outwardly, to show whether we believe what we say we believe. God doesn't put evil in front of us and then watch, trying to catch us doing wrong. He's not placing a temptation in front of us saying, if they fail, that proves to them they don't have faith. God doesn't tempt us to do wrong. Okay, any temptation we face is from ourselves, our own desires, or it's from Satan. And that's what James chapter 1 says. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil. He himself tempts no one. God actually wants us to pass these tests. When God tests us, he's actually trying to build up our faith. He's not trying to get us to fail. He's not trying to get us to stumble. He wants us to be built up in our faith. Okay, another way to say this, God tests his people in order to build their faith, not to destroy it. He's not trying to cause us to fall away from him. He's not trying to cause us, you know, to fall into the ditch and be stuck there forever. He does want us to know the reality of it, though. He wants us to know whether or not our faith is real, whether it's true. And so in that, he wants us to pass the test. Listen to this. Whenever God tests us, he is seeking to prove the genuineness of our obedience. We say that we trust God, but will we trust him when the time comes? We say that we love God, but will we love him with our choices and actions? We say that we know God, but do we let our knowledge of God influence our decisions and relationships? God will test us. He expects his people to live outwardly all the things they believe inwardly. The test isn't what earns the relationship with God. The test proves that we have one. And the test is for us and the others around us. God receives glory when his people obey. He doesn't need the outcome of the test, but he wants us to see it. He wants us to grow in our trust of him. He wants us to grow up in our faith. So God will test us as a way to grow us. God will test us as to help us be more aware of the reality of the authenticity of our own faith. And the only proper response to a test is simple. It's obedience. You do what God asks. This isn't calculus. This is simple addition. If subtraction is too hard for you, okay, we'll stop at addition, but this is not complicated things. This is simply doing the things that God would have you do. Okay, and that's the response to any test. And so it's important to realize God will test us. Okay, we might not like the sound of that. We may think that, okay, this is a negative thing. And, you know, I thought the video clip almost portrayed it as a negative, as if it certainly caused Abraham some struggle internally. But he sort of asks at the beginning, again, really? And I don't think that's right. I don't think the video clip matches Abraham's heart, at least what the scripture reveals of it. For us, we need to be ready and willing to obey God even when we're tested, because the test will come. And again, God's not trying to tear us down. He's not trying to wear us out. He wants us to be fruitful. He wants us to be sure. He wants us to be confident that we have the faith that we say that we have. All right, so Abraham, 40 to 50 years into his life, God tests him yet again. And here's the test. We'll reread the passage. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, he saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw a place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went both of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his thorns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said, "To this day on the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided." All right, so God tells Abraham, go offer your son Isaac as a sacrifice. He takes him up to this mountain. He's going to make him a burnt offering. There's no ambiguity here. Abraham knew what the outcome of this was going to be, his son's death. Okay, Abraham wakes up early in the morning, just gets up and does it. He grabs his stuff. He grabs some wood. He grabs a torch. He grabs a knife. And he brings along a few of his servants, and he grabs his son, Isaac. And they start off on this journey. They travel for 3 days. It was roughly about a 50-mile journey that they went on. Okay, eventually, Abraham sees their destination. It's Mount Moriah. It's off in the distance. You can see the mountain. Anybody ever driven out west? You see the mountains coming. It takes you 3 days to actually get to the mountain once you're going. Once he sees his destination, he and Isaac continue onward by themselves. They leave the other people behind, the servants. Along the way, Isaac finally seems to notice there's no animals with him. I don't know what he thought. Hey, maybe we'll pick up something along the way. But they're in the mountains. This is off in just, you know, the desert. Basically, there's nothing out there. And so he realizes, we're not going to come across any animals to sacrifice here. And so he asks. Abraham answers, "The Lord will provide. No, don't worry." So apparently Isaac didn't know the plan yet. He didn't know exactly what was going to happen when they got there. They arrive on the mountain. Abraham ties Isaac up. I don't know if he hit him over the head first with a big rock. That's a joke. Okay, this is already horrible enough. But he ties him up. He lays Isaac down on the pile of wood. He made an altar. Abraham stands over Isaac with a knife, and this is where the video did an amazing job, and you got to wonder what's going through his head at that point in time. About the time he decides to do it, angel of the Lord calls out to Abraham and says, "Abraham, stop." Okay, he says, "Don't go through with it. Now I know that you fear the Lord. Now I'm not going to withhold from you the things that I've promised, the blessings that have been promised." Okay, from there, Abraham sees an animal, a ram. He goes and takes that, sacrifices it, and he names the place "The Lord will provide." Now, this is just a strange story in a couple of different ways. At first glance, okay, God calls Abraham to leave his home country. God says, "I'm going to give you a son." Abraham has to wait 25 years for that son to come into existence, to be born. Isaac then grows up for probably 20 to 30 years more, and now God says, "Abraham, go kill that son." It seems a little counterproductive, doesn't it? Abraham's got to wonder, what the heck? It also just seems kind of terrible on a human level. Was God really asking him to kill his son? Does God ask parents to kill their children? to murder them. I mean, it's a sacrifice. If God asks you to do something, I guess it can't be wrong because God's holy and he doesn't sin. But does God really ask people to do this? And again, doesn't the Bible speak against this? Doesn't God instruct the Israelites, don't do this? Don't be like the pagan nations? Because there are other nations that exist at this time that are doing this. There are groups of people that are sacrificing their children as a sacrifice to their God, as a show of devotion, as a show of worship. Is God really asking him to mimic what those other groups are doing? And this is where it's important that we know what the Bible says. This is where it's important that we know that the Bible is all about Jesus. The entire story before we get to the Gospels is pointing ahead to Jesus, and we get glimpses into that story. Everything that happens during the Gospels is Jesus. Everything afterwards is explaining, because of Jesus, here's what we do. This won't make sense unless we kind of understand the big picture of the entire Bible. It's not that God wanted Abraham to kill his son. He asked him to offer his son. I don't think he gave Abraham any indicator that he'd stop him before he goes there. It's not like God changed his mind halfway through. I guess this is a bad idea. Or I guess it's wrong to kill somebody, so stop. That's not it. He didn't want Abraham to kill his son. He wanted Abraham to offer his son. And that's important. God was working a much greater purpose in all this. This was a precursor. This is a preview of what he was going to do through Jesus' death on the cross 2,000 years after this. This is a lived out parable, almost a prophecy of what he was going to do. And we'll talk through those details in a second. And so that's one thing. The other thing, this was for Abraham. He was teaching Abraham. He was training him. Apparently, Isaac had become something of an idol to Abraham. And God was asking him, how much do you love the boy? Do you love him more than I do? Or I'm sorry, do you love him more than you love me? There's a sense in which God is teaching and training, instructing Abraham, you got to love God first, above everything else. Okay? And a byproduct of that is we get the truest definition of faith from the entire Bible, from what Abraham did as he responded to God through these stories. It's impossible to please God without faith. We see that Abraham is the father of our faith, even for Christians. It was for the Jewish nation, he's their father of their faith. Even for Christians, he's the father of our faith. We get a working definition of faith by Abraham's response here. Okay, so he's working something out in Abraham. He's going to use this, God is, to instruct us on what faith is as well. So we'll look at those two points here as we move forward. First, it was a preview of what God would do 2,000 years later on the cross. The intention of these events, this transcends Abraham and Isaac. Okay, the story is about them, but it's about a lot more than them. The story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac on a cross, Isaac was a preview of Jesus' death on a cross. How do we know this? Just look at the details of the story. Okay, Abraham willingly gives up his only son to be killed. Did you notice that? Does Abraham have more than one son? I mean, technically, yeah. He's got Ishmael. Ishmael seems to be out of the picture. So why is God calling Isaac his only son? Maybe his only legitimate son? I guess you could go that. How about when God talks about Jesus in the New Testament? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever would believe could have life through him. The language here is similar. God gave up his only son. Abraham was giving up his only son. Secondly, Isaac is an adult son who submits to the will of his father. Like I said earlier, Isaac probably wasn't a young boy. They use the word lad as one of the translations, which I love. But honestly, that just means an unmarried single male. And so it could mean up into the 20s. Most commentaries said he's probably in his 20s or 30s. One person tried to say he was exactly 33 years old, and I think they're trying to force the fact that he was representing Jesus in this story. I think that might be taking it a little bit too far, because when I checked his math, it just didn't add up. But an adult male son submits to his father. Isaac could have overpowered Abraham. He's a strapping young lad at this point in time. He could have fought off his dad. But he didn't. He submitted, just like Jesus submitted to his heavenly Father. You guys remember the Garden of Gethsemane? Jesus is praying before the Father. This is the night he's arrested before he gets arrested, tried, and killed. And he says, Father, if there's any other way, but yet not my will, but your will be done. Jesus submitted to the will of the Father, just like Isaac submits here. Isaac carries a pile of wood to the top of a mountain to his own death. Does that sound familiar? Jesus carries his own cross on the road until he can no longer carry it. He'd been beaten so badly at his trial. Eventually, a stranger comes along and they have him carry it the rest of the way. But Isaac carries the wood of what's literally going to be the thing that kills him when he gets to the top of the mountain. Next, Isaac was essentially dead, at least in Abraham's mind, for 3 days. God tells Abraham, take your son and sacrifice him. From then on, Isaac is dead in Abraham's mind. For 3 days, they journey, going to the place where God's going to show him. Well, Jesus was in the grave for how many days? 3. This represents Jesus being in the grave and resurrecting to actual life. Okay, killed in the middle of the day on a Friday, in the grave, that day is 1, Saturday is 2, Sunday morning's 3. Resurrected back to real life. Next, all this happens in a place called Mount Moriah. That was in a mountain range near a place called Salem back at the time. Salem gets renamed Jerusalem. This is actually one of the mountains that makes up the city of Jerusalem. Okay, these mountains later get referred to by a totally different name. They get called Calvary. Most people believe this is the exact same place that Jesus hangs on a cross, the same mountain, Mount Moriah, where Isaac and Abraham are. It's the same place that Jesus died on the cross. Remember, he ventured out of the city. They hung him on a cross on a hill outside of the city. Most people believe that's used to be called Mount Moriah. Now it's called Calvary or Golgotha. It's almost like all this is just a play-acted prophecy of Jesus' death. I mean, this is chapter 22 of the entire Bible. Anybody know how many chapters there are in the Bible? It's a lot, thank you. It's accurate. There's over 1,000 verses in the entire Bible. We're 2% into the Bible, and we're already getting glimpses of who Jesus is and what he's going to do. All the details are relevant. The tone of the story, the overall story, match pretty close to what Jesus goes through for us 2,000 years after this happened. But here's the thing. This wasn't pretend. This didn't just happen in God's imagination. This was people's real lives. They actually had to walk through this. They actually had to play out the details of the story. Okay? This was their life. This wasn't a script. It also wasn't a daydream or imagination. It wasn't a vision. It was life. And so their part in the story, even though it's about something much bigger, that doesn't make their part in the story any less significant. Okay, and that's what I want to look at next, because we see an example here of this amazing obedience, both from Abraham and from Isaac. This is something for us to learn from. This is something for us to imitate. This is something for us to follow. Okay, this is what obedience is supposed to look like. Anybody ever watch the TV show The Office? Okay, if you're a Christian, you do. Non-Christian, no. Okay, so without giving too much backstory in this, there's characters that are at odds with each other. One of them's kind of the quirky, he's not the main character, but he's kind of the irritant in the show. His name's Dwight. One of the other main characters' name is Jim, and he's kind of the good guy. You're supposed to root for him, although he's not all great. But anyway, Dwight just does all sorts of dumb stuff. And pretty soon after a while, it's not just the dumb stuff that he does, it's the Dwight type of dumb stuff that he does. There's like a flavor to his dumbness that's, oh, that's so Dwight. Well, they start, I'm getting the details wrong. Anyway, one of the other characters comes along and he says, boy, you really shrewded that one. And it's Dwight's last name is Shrewd. But he starts to define an action by the person's character. It's like, that's a Dwight type of name or type of action. So you really shrewded that. You guys with me so far? Those of you that don't watch The Office, you're like, when is this gonna end? Abraham's example here for us, Isaac's example here for us, this defines faith. These are the first men that walked with God formally according to his promises and mankind's response. Anybody that approaches God has to have some understanding of what do I do? How do I do this? As Adam and Eve were in the garden with God, face-to-face interaction. Others after them, they had interaction with God. It doesn't get described as overtly as Abraham. The reason why Abraham's the father of our faith is because we get to see in him how mankind is supposed to relate to God. The definition of faith comes from what we see Abraham doing. The definition of obedience comes from what we see Abraham and Isaac doing. And so if we want to shroot it according to our faith, we follow Abraham's example. We want to Abraham it. Okay, we want to have the faith of Abraham. Jesus gets into this long argument with the Pharisees in the New Testament. They're saying, our father isn't the devil, our father is Abraham. And Jesus argues back against them. Well, you're not doing the things Abraham's doing. Okay, but the definition of faith comes from these events. So let's look at what faith should look like. All right, Abraham, he was obedient in his actions. It says he woke up the next morning, probably did his morning devotions, drank his morning coffee. He gathers wood and fire. He grabs a knife. He sets off on a three-day journey, walks 50 miles. He does everything God asks him to do. Okay, so you'd say his obedience was immediate. His obedience was thorough. Okay, and that's important when it comes to faith and obedience. His obedience was in his attention to the specific instructions from God. He goes to the exact place God tells him to go. He doesn't go to a place that's like it. He goes to the place God shows him. He brings along the correct son. Okay? And Ishmael's out of the picture now, and so I don't know if there was opportunity there, but God named Isaac by name. Abraham followed through by bringing the correct son. He gathers everything he needs to execute the plan. His obedience was not vague or lazy. It was focused. Okay, it was intense. Is your obedience to God focused? Or is there a vagueness to it? Where you kind of do most of it right, and you trust that God will maybe understand? His obedience was focused and specific. Abraham was obedient in his attitudes. Okay, there's no recorded complaining. There's no recorded hesitations. There's no loss of trust for God as he does this. If you read on into the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 11 gives a long commentary about Abraham's life. Hebrews chapter 11, read this, starting in verse 17. It was by faith that Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice when God was testing him. Abraham, who had received God's promises, was ready to sacrifice his only son, Isaac, even though God had told him, Isaac is the son through whom your descendants will be counted. Abraham reasoned that if Isaac died, God was able to bring him back to life again. And in a sense, Abraham did receive his son back from the dead. We get a glimpse into Abraham's attitude at this point. He didn't lose trust in God. He figured the plan was still the same, and if God wanted him to sacrifice his son Isaac, God must have another plan then. God will resurrect him from the dead and will continue on as promised. His obedience was pure. It wasn't external only. It was from the heart. He didn't just do the right thing. Okay, he trusted God. And we see that later on in the Bible, Hebrews chapter 11. Okay, let's talk about Isaac for a second. Isaac obeyed without knowing the entire plan. We see that along the way. He's like, why don't we have any little lambies with us? Like, what are we going to do when we get there? He didn't know all the details, and yet he still put in the work. He's still carrying the wood. He's still walking along with his dad. He's still going to the place where they wanted to go. He was willing to walk in uncertainty as part of his obedience in all this. He didn't know the full picture. Now, I spent a lot of time with a lot of younger guys and gals in the college ministry, and this is one thing that differentiates the males from the females. 20-something, young people, college, out of college, the guys always need to know all the reasons why you're doing something, or they may or may not do it. Okay, no offense, guys, but take offense. The girls are much better, the gals, they're much better at being like, okay, we're doing this, okay, and kind of waiting on the explanation. I'm not saying we shouldn't have some understanding as we go through with things, but will you only do something if you understand the full picture, if you understand the full plan? Is that kind of where you're at with this? This is where I'm sorry, guys. It's not just the young people that do this. I see it in the 20-somethings. It happens everywhere. A lot of people are unwilling to obey God because they don't quite understand how things are going to add up. Instead of simple obedience, they think through all the possibilities and say, that's not going to work. And so they don't go through with it. Isaac was willing to walk in uncertainty. He's willing to obey God in uncertainty. He also obeyed without being in full control. He trusts his father. He trusts that his father Abraham is led by God in these things. So his obedience, he was willing to submit to the human authority in his life. And here's the thing. For most of us, that's going to be most of the opportunity to obey God that we'll ever see in our life. Obeying, submitting to the various authorities and relationships and other people that God has placed in our life. It's almost going to always come through our human interaction with our friends, with our church family, with our pastors, with our ministry leaders. Most of the opportunity to obey the Lord is going to come through the human authorities that God has instilled in our life. And I think this one's difficult. I mean, mankind is naturally rebellious. Okay, we're Midwesterners, we're Northerners, we're naturally rebellious. Okay? I don't think it's hard for us to think God probably knows better. I think it's hard for us to think somebody else knows better. To submit to that idea. Somebody else actually might know better. And that takes faith. And that requires some trust. And that will test our obedience. Isaac also obeyed without regard to his own well-being. Okay, he offers himself as a sacrifice, literally. Okay, he is sacrificial, literally. He gives up his own rights. He lays down his own life. The video we watched at the beginning of the sermon, I don't know what his reaction was. The Bible doesn't record what his reaction was. Whether he resisted or not, that'd be natural enough, right? Whether Abraham did conk him on the head with a big rock, again, it's still a joke. But there's no recorded time where he's complaining or protesting this. It doesn't say he struggled against his father when he did this. So you have to assume he went along with God's plan in this. His obedience was absolute. From these guys, we gain a valuable example of what faith and obedience is supposed to look like. Okay, we're supposed to imitate the people we read about in the Bible, not in everything. Sometimes their example is what not to do, but oftentimes it's what to do. We're supposed to imitate that, and we're supposed to learn from these stories. Learn what faith is, learn what obedience is, even if it's to these extreme levels that we're reading about today. And so we're supposed to imitate the faithful. These guys are from 4,000 years ago. Abraham, Isaac, they lived 4,000 years ago. Yet we're still supposed to be like them. Okay, Hebrews comments on this. In chapter 6, it says that you may be imitators of those who through faith and patience inherited the promises. This doesn't mean we're going to live exactly like Abraham or Isaac. This means we'll imitate the endurance they showed, the patience they had, the trust they demonstrated in God. Because here's the thing, God wants us to have the same assurances that he was giving them. If we'll follow their example in this, we'll actually receive the same, similar relationship with God that they had. God assures them. God, in a minute here, God's going to swear by himself that these things are going to come true. I'm not saying we'll have those verbal interactions with God in the same way, but with the Holy Spirit living on us, we'll have peace. We'll have calm. There'll be trust in God. There'll be joy. And we can have that affirmation from God that, yep, we're doing the things that he wants us to do. We can be led by the peace we have with God. We're supposed to be instructed by these stories. Okay, again, sometimes it's what not to do. A couple semesters ago for campus church, we went through the book of Judges. And there's like two or three decent people in the entire book of Judges, and that's pushing it. You're not supposed to be like Samson. Just because he's big and strong and sort of a modern-day anti-hero, he's an adulterer, he's a drunk, he's just arrogant as could be. He had no friends. That was Samson's biggest problem. He had no friends. We're not supposed to imitate him, but we can learn from him. This story, we have a positive example, what to learn from. Okay, and the Bible even comments on this. We should be instructed by these stories. Romans chapter 15, verse 4, whatever is written in the former days was written for our instruction, that through the endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures, we might have hope. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction. We're supposed to learn from these things. And so we pull details out of these stories of what obedience is supposed to look like. That's supposed to instruct us. That's actually supposed to help us in our day-to-day. And that's why we spend the time doing this. All right, if this all sounds way too severe, like too extreme, I would only encourage you to read the Bible a few more times. If all this sounds like it's too much, you need to know Jesus expects full obedience. He expects extreme obedience, immediate. He expects complete obedience. If this all seems like it's crazy stuff, I just would invite you to just read the scriptures and see if this doesn't go start to finish, the exact same heart running through it. God expects full, unconditional, complete obedience from us. If you don't intend to obey God like this, you probably don't love God. And I'll take the word probably out of that statement if I could say it one more time. You don't love God. Jesus says, if you love me, you'll obey me. This is what we're tested along the way. When God tests you, your obedience demonstrates whether you love him or not. If you won't obey God like this, then you're not actually following him. Jesus says, if anybody would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That's what's being tested along the way. Are you still following God? Are you still walking with Jesus? That's what's being tested. The ultimate goal for a Christian is to give your own life to God and let him do whatever he wants with it. Just like Isaac, we're supposed to crawl up onto the altar, allow our life, as we know it, to be done away with so that God can do whatever he wants with us. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. So again, just like Isaac, you crawl up onto the altar, you offer God your life, and you let him do with it what you want. So a couple of questions before we skip onward. Are you willing to learn from the example of others? The examples here in the Bible, the examples of the people around you. Are you willing to learn from the examples of others? Are you willing to be instructed by the Bible? I think a lot of us in this room probably read the Bible, but are you being instructed by it? Do you actually read it and receive instruction from God on how to live? 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16, the Bible is good for a lot of things. Instruction, I'm probably butchering this, is breathed out by God for correction, for, Jason, help me. Reproof. Keep it coming. When we read the Bible, we're supposed to be instructed. We're supposed to be corrected. We're supposed to be reproved, rebuked, all these things. Is that happening when you read the Bible? Is it happening to you still? It's 5 years in, 10 years in, 20 years in. Are you instructed by the Word of God? And then lastly, are you willing to lay down your life on the altar and put your life into God's hands? If you're willing to do this, and this is what Abraham was willing to do, this is what Isaac was willing to do, then you experience the blessing of God. Blessing comes through obedience. I'm not saying all of God's blessings come directly through your, you know, accurate and your successful obedience. But if you want the blessing of God, God expects obedience on your part. Let's finish up this passage real quick. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. He said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and you have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. And I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." And Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. All right, so in response to Abraham, his faith, his obedience, God says, "By myself, I've sworn all these things will happen to you." God reiterates some of the same promises, some of the same blessings that he had said previously. "I'll multiply you, I will bless you," and all the rest. And this brings up some questions. Okay, why did God keep reiterating this? In the last 10 chapters of the Bible, like 3 or 4 times, God's telling Abraham the same thing on repeat. It's probably a nice reminder, probably trying to help Abraham remember and be confident that he's still going in the right direction. But honestly, God's communicating some things through all these repeated interactions. Does this mean that Abraham had to earn the promises of God? I mean, does he keep telling him? He's like, "Not good enough yet, not good enough yet. You're almost there." Is that what God's doing here? And I don't think that's the case. If we kind of speed through the last 10 chapters, in chapter 12, he calls Abraham to leave his home and go to a place, and he's going to become a people. This is the call of Abraham. Chapter 15, God sort of promises Abraham with a covenant, "I'm going to give you this land that you're in." Chapter 18, he reiterates the same things, but he gives him a new covenant of circumcision. This is more of a relational deal. This is a conditional covenant. God says, "If we're going to be together in this, here's the terms of the agreement. I'll bless you if you continue to walk with me. But if you don't, or if any of your future generations don't, then you're cut off." So he sort of says, "I'm going to bless you, but if." Okay? We get to chapter 22 here. After all of this, it's already been promised to him. And God says, "Because you have done this, now I know you fear me, and now I'm definitely going to do it." That's all he's saying. God's doubling down on this idea that your promises are going to come true. God guarantees this. He already promised it, and now he guarantees it. Does that make sense? Okay, no? Doesn't? Okay, let's read Hebrews chapter 6. Verse 13 through 18, it says, "When God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely I will bless you and multiply you.' And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes, an oath is the final confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath." That by two unchangeable things, one, that God can't lie, but these things will come true. It'll be more certain. Two unchangeable things: God's promise, and then just to make it all the more sure for Abraham, he throws on this oath. "I swear by my own name that this will be true." Okay? Just in case you don't believe me, just in case you're wondering, that's where God's coming in at the end. That's the repetition of this. And this is just sort of the crescendo of all these promises. God says, "Abraham, I'm going to bless you. You did it. You passed the test. I'm going to bless you." But here's the thing. This is the principle behind this. Blessing comes from obedience. You can't really expect to be blessed by God if you're not walking with God, if you're not obeying God. There might be good things along the way, but that comes to challenge the idea of what are blessings. Is blessings always good things? Health and wealth and ease and comfort? You know, life goes easy for you. You get a pony for your birthday. No. Not a blessing, I get it. No. Blessing comes from obedience. But blessing is you're walking with God in an unrestricted relationship. You're secure. You get all of him and he gets all of you. That's to walk in blessing. That doesn't mean things are always going to go great. That doesn't mean you always get what you want. But when you're in that place where you're at peace with life, with God, with the people around you, and it might not even include the people around you, to be honest, but that's blessing. That's the blessing Abraham had. Okay, blessing means that God is for you. Blessing means you got nothing to worry about. Blessing means that God is not going to leave you. God is not going to forsake you. God is with you every step of the way. If you're not obeying God, you have no reason to be confident that God is there with you. In that moment, I'm saying. God's not going to leave you just because you have a bad day. But I'm talking life as a whole. If you haven't made your life about walking with God, should you really expect the things that God says he'll do to those who walk with him, should you really expect those things to be happening in your life? Blessing comes from obedience. And I wonder where we're at with all this. Do you believe that you can walk in God's perfect blessing? That if you give God all of yourself, that he'll actually reciprocate all the things that he said? I'm not saying we're earning God's favor. I'm not saying that you're earning even salvation with God. These are things he freely gives, but there's a relational aspect to all of this. Do you expect to live a life rich with God's blessings if you're just ignoring him 6 days a week? 6.5 days a week? Do you expect that to be true? God's blessings are freely given, but there is something of a cost. Let me give you at least an analogy here, and then we'll wrap it up. Imagine you get free tickets to a concert in Minneapolis. Okay, they're free. It's a band you really want to go see. You don't got to pay for them. I don't know what concert tickets go for these days. 10, 12 bucks, you know? That's like probably like 50 or 100 or 150 bucks. Okay, the tickets are free, but you got to find some friends to go with you. You got to drive over and brave the Minneapolis traffic, which you don't want to do, by the way. You've got to pay for parking. You got to make your way to your seat through the crowd of people. You got to put up with all the people doing drugs around you. You got to basically wrestle the crowd to get back to your car. You got to fight traffic on the way home. You got to wake up early the next day and make it to work on time. The tickets were free, but the whole experience, it was kind of costly, wasn't it? It required an awful lot from you if you were going to experience the blessing. And I do think God's blessing is an awful lot like that. Okay? Just because you obey doesn't mean you're going to guarantee good things from God. Doesn't mean you're going to just, okay, God, here's my obedience. Now give me the blessing. It's not one-to-one like that, but a life lived in faithful obedience to God does receive back, include promised by God, guaranteed by an oath that God's going to make the blessings he says in the Bible available to you. Let's pray. Father, thanks for your word. Thanks for a story that has an awful lot of application to it. There's real actors and characters in the story. There's real children of yours that went through some extreme lows just to experience even more of your blessing. And we thank you for the example of Abraham. Thank you for the example of Isaac. We ask that you teach us every time we read about this, every